Space Cowboy Books presents Simultaneous Times, a science and speculative fiction podcast. Short stories to stir the imagination by contemporary authors.
Come Home, Laika by Douglas A. Blanc, with music by Patrick Earn, read by Jean-Paul Garnier. The inner hull vibrates as the dropship enters the upper strata of the atmosphere. The pull of Earth's gravity grabs our space armor and presses us into our seats. Me and a dozen of my fellow Marines are strapped into two rows of benches as the landing craft begins to buck. Sergeant Lassie walks up and down the aisle between the benches. She has her helmet off and approaches each of us one by one. She leans in close and rubs her muzzle against each of her Marines, growling words of encouragement. When it's my turn, she flashes her teeth and says, "Corporal Tracker." She strokes her muzzle against mine. Her smell reminds me of my mom and littermates far away on Canis Major. I sigh, and my neck and shoulders relax. Sarge whispers in my ear, "Who's a good boy?" Unconsciously, my back leg bangs rhythmically against the metal deck. As Sergeant Lassie moves on to the others, I notice a persistent squeaking noise across from me. Scout, a nervous husky from Cerebus Prime, is chewing compulsively on a star-shaped squeaky toy strapped to the front of his armor. "Scout," I hiss across the aisle. "Get it together." "I can't, dog," Scout whispers through clenched teeth. "I hate these drops. The loud noises, the flashing lights. I can't take it, dog." The toy in his mouth squeaks louder and faster. I pull my glove off and loosen my chest harness. I reach across with my bare paw and gently scratch Scout under the chin. The squeaking slows and then stops as he drops the toy. He opens his mouth and begins panting. "Thanks, dog. I needed that." Someone down the row calls out, "Hey, Rin Tin, why you drinking so much?" A German shepherd with a bad scar over her eye lifts her head from a bowl of water and barks, her muzzle dripping. "I'm going to piss on every human bunker we clear. Need to load up the old bladder." The dogs around her bark with laughter. "Listen up, pups," Sergeant Lassie yells. She's finished her rounds and is standing in the middle of the aisle. "We are about to make our final descent to the surface. We expect heavy resistance on the ground from the humans. Don't be afraid. You are not alone. We are one of thousands of dropships, carrying tens of thousands of Marines. And when we land, we will form one of the biggest packs these human scum have ever seen." The cabin erupts with barks and howls. "Earth," Sarge continues solemnly, "is the key to our struggle for liberation. We have fought the hairless apes for thousands of years on hundreds of outer planets. Today, we bring the fight to them. No canine has ever set paw on Earth as a free dog. Today, we come with no collars." Barking and howling again. "Today, we come with no leashes and no microchips. We do not come spayed or neutered. We do not come naked. We come armed to the teeth." My fellow Marines bang the metal deck and bark. "We do not return to Earth with our tails between our legs, but held high." At the far end of the cabin, a retriever jumps out of his seat and turns around to display his fluffy blonde tail, wagging madly. "Private Goldie," Sergeant Lassie bellows, "sit down and put your damn tail back in your armor, unless you want to lose it." Everyone turns and looks at Stumpy, a gray schnauzer seated at the end of the bench with her head down. She lost her tail 2 years ago in the Battle of Io and gained a new nickname. They all laugh at her. Without looking up, she raises her paw and lifts the middle digit. This elicits even louder barks. Still, she doesn't look up from her lap. Oh, come on, Stumpy, says Goldie. What are you looking at that's so interesting? Stumpy pushes her glasses up on her nose. I'm reading this holodisc about Laika. Scout wrinkles up his nose. Laika? What's Laika? The disc says she was the first dog in space, Stumpy says, reading from a small holo display in her paws. 4,000 standard years ago, on Earth, a group of human scientists kidnapped Laika off the street in a city called Moscow. It was believed that she had pups, but they were left behind. These scientists performed experiments on her for a year. An old grizzled beagle next to me growls in the back of his throat. They strapped her into a teeny capsule with a feeding tube and a diaper, and wired her with electrodes to monitor her heart rate and body temperature. Capsule was placed on top of a liquid oxygen kerosene rocket, and... Stumpy looks up for the first time, her eyes watering. She was launched into orbit. She was alone? Goldie gasps. Yeah, she was alone. The only sound is the groaning of the hull and the rumble of the heat shields under our paws. After a moment, she continues. During launch, Laika's heart rate reached 300 BPM, but she reached orbit successfully. The capsule was equipped with air recyclers and thermal regulators, enough for 10 days. But there was a malfunction, and within a few hours, the temperature inside the capsule rose. Her heart stopped after 3.5 revolutions around Earth. Her dead body continued to orbit for 6 months. Then she was burned up on re-entry. Stumpy shuts off the disc and looks at her fellow Marines. A huge Great Dane growls, "Human scum." "Barbarians," someone mutters. Outside the teeny portholes, the hull is glowing orange as the dropship hits thicker layers of atmosphere. Sergeant Lassie sighs and stands. All right, pups. Load your gear and stow your fear. She slaps her rifle. Laika is not alone today, pups. We are here, and we're going to bring Laika home. We bang our boots on the deck and rise our heads to howl together as one pack as we hurtle towards Earth. Color on the Lure by Jacob Stephen Moore, with music by Fog Machine, read by Jean-Paul Garnier. True, very true. I'm breathing better now, by degrees, better with every breath. At least my words don't gurgle. At least they've pumped the seawater out of my lungs. The pain across my arms is better too. But I'm not cured, no, not by any stretch. So they won't let me leave this comfortable place. Not that I have any desire to go. I'll start in at the beginning for you. It was a year, or a year and a month, of watching the stars roll through the bowl of the sky before I found him. A comet with a tail like a long flaming sword carved through the darkness in June. Then in July, the papers ran this on page 6. Giant Pacific octopus discovered with 9 arms to be flown to DC National Aquarium. I phoned my travel agent the next day, and by the week after that, I was in Washington. I got the night watchman job. I have no experience guarding over anything, but I'm quite good at talking to people. And the man and woman interviewing me liked my manners well enough. Plus, I was well motivated to persuade them I was their man. They handed over a badge and a flashlight and a key ring that opened the whole complex. I smiled warmly as I shook each of their hands in turn. 9-1 odds, I'd never see either of them again. That first day, Lord, The wait for evening was an anxious frenzy. I had no residence in the capital, only a hotel room booked under a false name. I sat on the bed, staring at a single point of light reflected in the television's black expanse. My leg bounced. Outside, the sun crawled on its belly. But I kept my cool. I'd waited too long to lose my composure. Weeks upon weeks of watching the stars march and dance until they told me what I needed to know. The hour came. A taxi, prearranged in my carefulness, took me to the aquarium's front gate. With my flashlight, I went to a side entrance and let myself in. My badge, plus a 4-digit password, entered within, deactivating the alarms. I renewed these with a punch of a button. Any other night, it wouldn't matter. But in that crackling moment, I was scared to death of being disturbed. The aquarium interior was all a strange half-darkness. My flashlight beam bounced off the glass of water-filled tanks, else it bent through them, warping shadows into clawing sinister shapes. I strode through the freshwater section, ignoring two alligators in their terrarium, floating in a dull stupor. It was not quiet. From all around came the hum of motors, the many mechanisms cleaning and agitating small oceans of water. And twice I heard my own footsteps echo, or saw my own reflection in the darkened glass as some approaching, looming horror. I confess it. My heart thundered as I entered that last darkened room. Outside of apocryphal descriptions and crude renderings in select text, I had no picture in my mind of how my master would appear. This was a new exhibit. The circular room was empty save for the 1,000-gallon tank rising like a Greco-Roman pillar in the center of the space. Appropriate for them to build a shrine. And here I had come. The first faithful to arrive, to worship, and hear. I pressed my face to the cold glass. My flashlight beam raced across the artificial stone reef, but I saw no movement. Only small specks of uneaten foodstuff drifting slowly. At first I was consumed with panic. Had I been deceived? Had a trap been laid for me? I imagined floodlights bathing me. Some bullhorn voice shouting through the dark, "It's all over, Creepo. There's no place to run. You're completely surrounded." But then, a miracle. My flashlight caught a flicker of subtle movement, and suddenly my master made his serene entrance, floating into view. My breathing quit for several moments. Not that I noticed as the ache began to bloom in my lungs. He was, at first, all over porcelain white. 4 feet long, including his muscular arms, with a wide bulbous cranium like the top of a sourdough loaf, and flat disc-like eyes set in horned lumps atop this. The bulge of the head was mottled like scarring from radiation, though the flesh along the trailing arms was smoother, sucker-tipped. These were, and constantly curling and grasping, searching out hungrily in every direction. The papers described him as 9-armed, some kind of nature freak. True, a 9th tentacle trailed among the others, hidden like a clownfish among the anemone's tendrils. But though my scientific knowledge is limited to crude observations of the natural world, even I saw what the paper writers and aquarium staff failed to grasp. The 9th appendage was not like its fellows. While the other 8 were boneless, this one was many-jointed, like a man's arm if he had 6 or 7 elbows hinging in all directions. Yes, even I could see it was not a product of our world. And what cause have I to lie? I'm handcuffed to this bed. Lying won't produce a key. Feverishly, I stroked my fingers across the curved glass. Euphoria gripped me. A year, or a year and a month of constant longing, all through now. A lesser man, I think, would have lost his senses then. Indeed, I was nearly overpowered by a kind of inner radiating cold, much as I'd imagined the void of space. But I recovered quickly. I held my breath as I began the prescribed signs. I greeted the master, introduced myself by name. I made a complicated gesture with one raised hand against the glass, and was thrilled to see a sucker-tipped arm touch the same spot as if in answer. Then I stood back. I held my breath and waited. One moment, then two, passed without comment from my master. Again, fear seized me. Had I done wrong somehow? Left some part incomplete? But again, my patience was rewarded. He rose up in the water, impossibly graceful. One arm, then four, then eight of the total nine fastened their suckers to the glass in front of my face. The knobby mutant ninth was tucked out of sight somewhere. The arms made a kind of star on the glass, centered on the dark gape of my master's great crushing beak. This opened, and I saw briefly the multitude of stars concealed within the inner, impenetrable darkness. But this first wonder was quickly forgot. From my master's spread-eagle body came a kind of pulse, disturbing the water. And then, color bled out into the world, spreading from the center of this radial array. At first, I thought it might be blood. But this fear quickly assuaged, like all the others. There was no solid substance carrying this tint. This was somehow color born of light, or without light entirely. Color present in its most unabstracted form. It couldn't be contained by water or by the glass enclosure. If I'd looked around the room, I might have seen the very walls awash with it. But my attention was drawn elsewhere. The color streaming from my master's body changed near constantly, fluctuating into stranger and more uncanny shade with each passing instant. As soon as one hue was birthed, another was close on its heels, rippling ever outward in an awesome eldritch rainbow. The cold pulse continued, and at the center of all, the master's beak opened and shut, revealing the countenance of the greater darkness, the greater cold that lay within. In any number of texts, explorers to the far north have rendered the chromatic majesty of the Aurora Borealis in poetic detail. So too have those who have voyaged in the deep ocean described the harsher predatory beauty of the bioluminescent creatures native to that sunless reach. I have long held that beauty such as this, beauty so great as to appear unearthly, serves a greater role. A purpose, in fact, not of this earthly realm. That beauty is in the eyes of the beholder holds true only for common terrestrial loveliness. For the colors and forms belonging strictly to the dark roving heavens, it is a constant and tremendous truth. Beauty, used as a tool of transmission, as a lure, a summons, an invitation, a gift. There, in the presence of my master, I had this belief confirmed. The top of his tank was unsecured. Even the amphibious creature his captors mistook him for could have escaped it easily if the urge struck him. But he'd made no such attempt. Was it possible he'd seen some sign as well, foretelling my arrival? Or had he drawn me here specifically, sought me as I'd sought him, certain of the truth that I alone would understand his message? It did not matter. I had come. I had understood. And I had scaled the enclosure, struggling now to maintain balance astride the tank's high wall and thrust aside the heavy lid. There was no hesitation here, only a brief elated moment where I let my anticipation build, letting the cold pulse's celestial splendor permeate every sense. Surely this was permitted. A pause, just before the climax, before the moment victory was assured. But my master was impatient. The longer ninth arm emerged, splitting the water's surface, raised as if in summons. I obeyed, and slowly, I dismounted and lowered myself into the cloudy, cold water. Many hours later, I was discovered. How many, I can't say. According to my accusers, I was face up floating at the water's surface. My master was curled in the far corner of the enclosure, completely inert. They hauled me out. I don't fault them for this rough treatment. They say I babbled like a lunatic just as soon as the salt water quit my lungs. I've got no memory of it. But now I'm here, in this lovely, comfortable place. And in spite of the terrible itching under these bandages, I'm content. Yes, quite content with my current habitat. The bandages? A necessary measure, I'm sure. My master handled me quite roughly, giving me his instruction. All down my arms, I can still feel the places where he gripped me, where his suckers bit into my flesh. In my vein stands a needle, numbing the pain from this transaction. But it can't quell the fiendish itch that made me writhe against my bonds at first, shaking in half-form words against my unseen captors. And yet, I say I'm content. I told you, the pain is lessened. I've got no reason to lie now. So I am happy where I am, elated even, completely euphoric. For the duties inscribed on my arm flesh were not the only gift bestowed by my master's brief embrace. Deep inside myself now, I feel the cold pulse of many tiny heartbeats. My only mistake, the malformed belief that he was really he at all. Imagine, please, what a gift. To shelter within myself that same extraordinary color I beheld in the aquarium room. A true honor, for which I alone have been selected. To become the invitation, the summons, the tool of transmission, the lure. I apologize for cutting this narrative short. I hear footsteps now in the hall. Soon the curtain will be swept aside and my poor, long-suffering attending nurse will appear again. I've got a lure of my own, you see. A bell to ring if I'm in distress. But I'm not in pain. Not yet. Only, my many little masters have sharp beaks and thousands of tiny, toothy arms. And they are already hungry. Beauty, they say, is in the eye of the beholder. I imagine we'll save hers for last. In this episode of Simultaneous Times, you heard Come Home Laika by Douglas A. Blanc, with music by Patrick Earn, and Color on the Lure by Jacob Stephen Moore, with music by Fog Machine. Theme music by Dane Luscombe. Come visit us at our bookstore in Joshua Tree or online at spacecowboybooks.com. Don't forget to subscribe, and visit us on Instagram and Twitter. We'd love to know what you think of the show.